Copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
The topic is how can Western missionaries contribute, European missionaries contribute to world missions. What I'm going to share with you is a hodgepodge of a lot of ideas. It's not really a systematic case for missionaries from the other part of the world. But if we are going to just start at the start, theologically, the body of Christ is one, and we benefit from each other. The body of Christ, of course, doesn't refer only to a local church, which sometimes it does, but the body refers to the whole, the church universal. And therefore, we can help each other. The partnership model of Antioch, it was a beautiful model where the daughter church sends money to the mother church, and the mother church sends the gospel to the daughter church. And so that was a good example of this. I just want to very briefly talk about where they can contribute and then talk about the whole issue of fostering integrity in when there is such a different cultural gap between Europe and our part of the world. As we look to see where we can contribute, where a European can contribute, what immediately comes to mind is specialists. The Western world can afford specialists because of its resources. And our contribution in our part of the world, maybe our contribution to the world church is integration, because we can't be specialists. We have to be generalists, and that enables us to be to integrate. We are forced to integrate more than perhaps the specialist. But the generalist feeds on the specialist, and the West can provide specialists to us because the West can afford to give people for higher studies, for research and things like that. So that's what immediately comes to mind, but I don't want to spend too much time on that. I think foreign missionaries who are not specialists in the traditional sense can also meet vital needs in our part of the world. I'm taking some examples. In Sri Lanka, we have an old church. The Dutch came to Sri Lanka about 400 years ago, and they established the Reformed Church in Sri Lanka. And so we've had a Protestant church for about 400 years. It could become quite slow and things like that. And then came these Koreans who came, especially to my church, the Methodist Church. They came, and we thought they were breaking a lot of the rules of committee and all of that. But they came with a real passion to evangelize. And I think it was God's time for the church, because just at that time, even through other movements, churches were taking evangelism a little more seriously. Earlier, evangelism was speaking to nominal Christians. And then these Koreans came and really began to go out to the lost. I think they had a big part to play. My church, my denomination, has been growing numerically in the past few years. We were about 25,000 members about 20 years ago, I think. Now we are about 38,000-40,000. So there's been a fairly significant growth. And that's been at a time when so many people left because of the war. And that came through conversion of people. And one influence in that was these Koreans who came. And, you know, I said they break all the rules, but God uses them in this unusual way. There's also people are reach. There is a growing westernized segment of our population who are among the hardest. We in Youth for Christ find the English-speaking youth of Sri Lanka the hardest to reach with the gospel. My son and my son-in-law are both trying to do this, and it's really difficult. They have to use their creativity so much. Now, they respond very positively to white people, right? People who have come from these European nations. And so they could do a ministry among that group. That's a very important segment, because a lot of the conversion that has been taking place recently has been among the poor. So the westernized people have been by and large untouched with the gospel recently. So this is another thing. But also, there is this need for godly parents for emerging leaders. Our churches are going through a time of great growth. There are no resources to care for the pioneers. It's a huge problem. In my own ministry, the first 15 years, my national role was to try and encourage people to go out to the unreached, because we had been always insular. That was the push. I remember one pastor telling me, you know, you asked us to go, but now that we are gone, no one is caring for us, you know. Especially after I stepped down, I have reduced my foreign travel and all of that, because I realized, my goodness, these people need care. We need to develop care. So these people don't have to be great specialists. What they need is godly parents. That missionaries can do. I know that there are missionaries in Sri Lanka, especially with the fastest growing denomination in our country, which is the Assembly of God. There are foreigners who are helping out very significantly with pastoral situations in the church. One of the biggest problems that we are having is burnout. These people are going, they're all alone, they struggle, they get persecuted and all of that, and burnout. A lot of them fall into financial woes. There is a strong emphasis on faith, and they go out in faith believing that God will provide, but they have not been wise. And after a few years, they are in huge financial difficulty. I would call it faith without method, you know, and consequently big problems. Some of them get trapped into sin, financial sin, sexual sin, or the sin of, authoritarianism, because they are alone, we are the only ones who are doing it, and so they can get trapped into sin. And loneliness is a huge problem. Sadly, I don't know from where we got this, but competition is still very much strong among the growing churches. So pastors find it difficult to be friendly with each other in a real good sense. So this is another thing. So godly parents for emerging leaders is something that can help. And then there are certain strengths in the West which are our weaknesses. The whole understanding of integrity. What is integrity? Management. I will later on talk about how the two clashes, the two structures are clashing. The Westerners can really help us with that, you know, with helping develop people of integrity. And then, of course, there are the tent makers. I think there is an important place, so long as we got into a bit of a trouble recently, because some people came as business people and didn't do any business at all. They were doing only evangelism, and then that came in the papers, and it was a big problem. So I think we have to really work on honesty in this. So this is why I say we must work by the rules. These are key needs. There is a place for specialists. There's a place for generalists, non-specialists. But I would say that the ministry that is truly penetrative is incarnational ministry. And for that, you need long-term. You know, I think there is a great value. There is a great value in short-term missions. There is no doubt about that. But there is the need for people to come, stay long-term, and you can be most effective that way. I grew up in a very westernized home, a church home. Western classical music was my, next to Bible teaching, that was my biggest interest. And God asked me to go and work with poor young people, you know, who work in the Sinhala language. I think he has a sense of humor. Now, I've done that now full-time for about 35 years. After a few years, I decided to move in that direction. And I am still blundering. I am still struggling I make so many mistakes because it's a different culture. And so so incarnational, you know, staying and working long term, there is great value in that. Though I know it's economically it's a real problem when you look at the economics and all of that. I think we have to take the economics seriously, but money never ruled the church. And so we shouldn't give that too much credence, this idea that, you know, a missionary costs so much. I think that's an important issue, but there are other pluses here. What kind of missionaries? Then secondly, there is a historical obstacle to overcome in most of our countries. The heyday of Western Protestant missions was in the colonial era. And whites were considered culturally superior. Colonialism fostered an attitude of dominance. We are the better culture. In our country, when we were growing up, a cultured person was one who spoke in English. The others were not cultured. And a gentleman was one who spoke in English. A man was one who didn't speak in English. That was the... Our people tolerated it during the colonial era because they had to survive, you know. And some people actually became Christians in order to get jobs in Christian schools and things like that, because they had no option. But today, that is gone. That is finished, that era. Many missionaries... Now, one of the things that is often forgotten is that many missionaries helped create an environment for the freedom struggles in the church. There's a lady called Dana Roberts who has written on this very well. And this is a neglected truth. A lot of the freedom fighters in our part of the world were trained in mission schools. Christianity fostered equality, which went against the colonial spirit, because the colonials said, we are superior, therefore you adopt our culture. Whereas missionaries came as servants. They said, we are equal. This is why colonial rulers generally didn't like missionaries. And the good missionaries, the heroes, were disliked, like Henry Martin and Hudson Taylor. They were disliked by the British leaders of the people representing Britain. Then some, though not many, some encouraged the freedom movements. They were involved in helping the rebellion against the nations. Of course, this was the time during the great liberal, most of the countries got independence at the time that there was the liberal evangelical wars in the church. So evangelicals generally stayed away from all kinds of political involvement. And so they didn't get that involved, but there were some who did. And those who did, like Stanley Jones, were criticized for doing that. They were accused of becoming liberal for having done things like that. So there is that side of the story. But now responsible, sensitive leaders will not tolerate the idea of Western dominance. But we are faced with it. Globalization. Everyone talks about globalization, but for most of our people, it's an ambivalent response that they have towards it. They have to reluctantly accept it as inevitable. Because if you're going to economically survive, you have to fall in line. But they don't do so happily. Because they are, and the Muslims have to give up their Quranic way of doing economics. That's one reason why they are so angry. The humiliation of having to give up everything that is so special as Western domination takes place. And they look for their time when they can once again dominate the world. So people are talking about globalization and all of this, you know, in multinational organizations and all of that, as the economic colonialism. And so there is that problem now. And of course, Christianity also is associated with colonialism. They say once they came with the Bible in one hand and the sword in the other, now they come with the Bible in one hand and dollars in the other to win our people to their religion. So that's another thing. Then, generally speaking, Westerners have so much more wealth than those in the other than in our part of the world. And in this time of rising expectations, of rising national pride and all of that, the Antioch model is a wonderful model because the daughter church was rich and the mother church was poor. And in the early church, poor people from the ruled community evangelized the rulers. So I think there is wealth is power all over the world, and we have to really ask, how can we break this strong stranglehold of the rich people from rich countries coming as missionaries? There is a disadvantage in that it's very difficult to forge equality. That's what I want to talk about a lot. And I think missionaries from the poorer European nations, this may be one of the ways out when the missionaries don't have so much wealth when they come. This may be one way to overcome this obstacle. The question is the Westerner must be equal not only in theory, but also, and by theological affirmation, but locals must feel equal to that person. How can that happen? I would say the key is an attitude of servanthood. I was greatly influenced by a Methodist missionary from Ireland, huge influence on my life. And the Sri Lankan church, the evangelical movement, was influenced a great deal by an American missionary with the team mission who started Back to the Bible broadcast in Sri Lanka. He was responsible for starting many other organizations in Sri Lanka. Both these people didn't speak our language. They ministered only in English. But still they had a huge impact. And I would say the reason was that they both had a servant spirit. They both were willing to be with our people and didn't come out as rich, powerful people. Of course, the Irish, for some reason, the Irish have a lot of affinity to our people culturally. I don't know why that is. And they always do well in Sri Lanka. It's not easy because many of the people in Sri Lanka and in many countries, the church is growing amongst the poor. So for the poor to feel equal is very difficult. So how can we pursue this partnership model? This is the big battle. I thought I will share something from our own pilgrimage. because we were like missionaries when we started working with the poor. We were from affluent backgrounds, speaking in English. I just thought I'll share with you something of what we went through that may help even missionaries in their attempt to identify. In our first few years, Youth for Christ, like many other countries, worked primarily with nominal Christians. And at that time, the church was a very English church, the Protestant church, no longer. But at that time, it was an English church. And then, once the youth fellowships began, we realized we don't have a ministry in the church anymore. Let's go out and send people to the church, but not use people you know, not minister among those people, because they know that now there are youth fellowships, we don't need it. So we completely realigned our ministry. But it was a huge shift for us. We are from Western backgrounds, our music is Western. We had to learn music all over again. Very difficult. I found it very difficult because I was trained in the bel canto style of singing. You know, that. And then suddenly we have to completely change the style. That doesn't work with our people. And so we had to learn music. We had to learn drama, because drama is very important in our people. And we had to learn afresh how to do drama. We had to study the religions. Actually, we went through a document that was very helpful to us that came out at the right time, called The Gospel and Culture. It was a Lausanne occasional paper. I took our staff through that, paragraph by paragraph, and so asked, how can we study, how can we do this? So we had to relearn how to proclaim the gospel. We had to start with God. We had to talk about the problem of suffering in a Buddhist country. And people began to come. So people came to Christ. As I said in the morning, at first the response was anger. These people had been liberated in Christ, and they realized we were kept down. Earlier they said, we can't help it, we have to accept it. Now they are equal, and when they are equal, they are angry. And we had to really work on saying, this is okay. Let them express their anger. Because the humble one may not be the one who's going to be a leader. The one who's angry may be the one who's going to be the leader. And it was a very painful process for us. There were a lot of other painful processes, especially when I started speaking in my language. I used to make a lot of mistakes, and people used to laugh, you know. And it was very painful for us. The whole idea of koinonia, another thing, I've studied Book of Acts a lot. And one of the things that influenced me a lot was Acts 2 and 4. And koinonia, what is koinonia? There's a very good book called Faith and Wealth by a historian, Justo Gonzalez, I think is his name. He shows that koinonia originally was used for business partnerships. It was a financial thing. And if you look at the way koinonia is used in Acts 2 and 4, it was also sharing not only of fellowship in our sense, but sharing of possession. So the koinonia went to the money, to their money also. So that made us ask ourselves, as we were going through, how are we going to create an organization where the rich and the poor are equal? So this was a big, we went through, it was a long process, and we have developed some principles, and I must tell you, we don't practice them 100%. There are some who revolt against the idea, but it's an ideal that we have been working towards. The first thing is that in our salary scales, we decided, following an example given by OMF, or the China Inland Mission, that salaries will be according to needs and not primarily according to position. So that if you have three children, and based on the age of the children, when the children get older, they have to go for tutorial classes and things like that. So there are more. The salary gets more. It's a very difficult thing to administer. And people say, now he's getting this, why am I not getting this? You know, it's very difficult. But we thought, we will try this, and our administration is done usually by people who come from the business world. And they, what is this? You know, they really find it very difficult to understand what this structure is. Then we decided, we tried to. Now let me say that when missionaries come, we have had missionaries at times. We don't expect them to come within the same scale as us, because they have expenses that are different. Their children's schooling is much more than our children's schooling. So things like that. So it has to be, it can't be legalistically followed. Love is at the heart of everything. Then Openness about personal wealth. Now, this is something that not everyone is open, but we try to be open with somebody about our personal wealth. My father was, you know, he was okay, doing okay financially. So he built me a house before I got married. And it's a nice house. And so now I had to ask myself, now what am I going to do? Am I going to sell this house? We felt the Lord was saying, keep your house open so that people can come and stay. And troubled children can come and find rest in our home. Then we decided to have an open salary book so that you can look at the salaries that others get. Again, very complicated because some people say, he's getting so much, how come, you know, so-and-so is not getting. But we felt that was the price of trying to foster this sense of openness and equality. Then sharing with each other and accountability, spiritual accountability, strong emphasis on accountability within the whatever group that you belong to. Again, using John Wesley's idea of the band, of an accountable group. Then with time we had to realize that we encourage dissent. In other words, if people are angry, they must be given an opportunity to talk. And in our cultures, for some reason, they are not used to debating. And when they debate, they fight, you know. And sometimes people come to our leadership from outsiders who come to our, especially the business person who comes from outside to our leadership team meeting. They are scandalized. Look at the way these people are fighting, you know. But we thought they must be given a chance to speak. And our people are not used maybe to speaking politely when they are fighting, that, you know, it becomes a bit of an impolite thing. Of course, we have to moderate it. You know, you can't just allow this to go on without... Then another thing, we took a decision, not a biblical decision, but just a practical decision that we took, that we won't publicize donors. In other words, the poor must give to our work. And the poor never give significant amounts. So the big donors will not be publicized. That was a very difficult thing. Somebody wanted to give us a hall in our campsite and name it after somebody. And we had to explain, we have decided to go against, you know, this is our policy. And it was very embarrassing for us. But this was so that the poor can feel that we are also giving and our giving is a responsible giving, is important giving. And the idea that the poor are paying my salary, and so I'm accountable to them. So these are things that we did. Soon we realized we will have to change our criteria for leadership in society and in the church. There are criteria for leaders, and very often the poor don't fit in. Now, one of the things I have come to realize after having worked about 35 years with the poor is that I will never be an ideal grassroots worker among the poor. I mean, I work, I go to the slums, I have people from the slums in my small group, I go almost every week, I go to the slums. And all of that. But I know that somebody from there is generally much more effective, especially evangelistically, than me. So if you are going to be effective among the poor, leaders must come from among the poor, which means that they don't have some of the criteria. In the Bible, the most important criteria for leadership are godliness and the ability to lead. You have to be able to lead. And you have to be godly. But in the church, education and the knowledge of English, because we are a former British colony, the knowledge of English and education are considered essential for leadership. So we had to change this criterion and give education after people join and become leaders, not before. And teach them English after, so that... The lack of a knowledge of English and of education may not hinder capable people from being leaders in the movement. Next month I'm also involved in a theological seminary, And we have our graduation next month. And I just found out, just before I came here, one of the guys in our ministry, he's like a son to me, he's from the slums. His father was the local illicit liquor person, you know, and rough. He was a rough guy. And to take out his roughness, well, still it hasn't gone, I think. But he's one of our key leaders. And he didn't graduate beyond 10th grade. He didn't go in school. He's going to graduate from the seminary. There are about 100 graduates, I think, and he's got the second highest grade. So it's a real real joy to me. But you know, we had to change. And then for some people, joining Youth for Christ meant a big drop in salary. For others, it was a rise. But, you know, we had to try and work that out. So what we wanted is an atmosphere where the poor feel equal. For example, in English, talking in English, in our language, they say sword. If you talk in English, you're wielding the sword. In other words, you're cutting somebody because you're showing that you're superior to that other person. That was what talking in English meant. So we had to tell our people, don't talk in English among yourselves when you are among these people, because then you are separating yourself from them. And so the atmosphere, an atmosphere where biblical values were the most important. So then these people came up to board level. Usually all our boards are in English, but our board is a trilingual board. In other words, you can speak in English, Sinhalese or Tamil, and there somebody will interpret for you. So it became a trilingual board. And also, the one who succeeded me, now I am a guy who's very much into education and several degrees and things like that. The person who succeeded me as the national director, the board felt, this is the guy who's most suitable for the job. He didn't finish high school, and he doesn't speak in English. He can speak a little, but he's not fluent in English. There are other staff who have master's degrees, one working on a PhD, on a DMin, who can speak English, but the board felt this is the guy who's the best leader in the group. So creating a structure where these people can fit in. So now I want to talk about one of the biggest issues in our cultures is the integrity issue. And this is something that that Westerners can be involved with in helping us develop integrity within our cultures. Often Westerners are attracted to people without integrity. The Western people who fit into the Western marketing approach to ministry, who can market their model well, but who are not truthful, our cultures are very spiritual. So our people pray very nicely, very earnestly. And so they hear this person with this tremendous marketing of his ministry and deep spirituality. And they say, man, we've got a found a person, a good person. So they're impressed, but we know these are the guys who can't be trusted. And this has happened over and over again. Community life that I've talked about, I believe, is the answer to the huge problem that we have in Asia, which is the problem of integrity and truthfulness. They are not high values among our people. The poor often think that it's nothing wrong for them to grab what they can from the missionary who has much more than us, you know. They have too much, we have too little, so we have a right to take what they have. And so, you know, there is so much of that. And then another problem is that people want to have their person, their ministry in Sri Lanka, and so they come, they find a person, and they offer him a job, and he just leaves. What he has been doing, the organization he's been working for, leaves, and, you know, comes, and it's an act of betrayal to the movement that nurtured you and all of that. So they are vulnerable to promises from a foreign donor, and they will leave. And on our side, there are two big problems. Firstly, local leaders are like kings, and the workers are like servants. And every leader wants to become a senior pastor so that they can be kings. And when a foreign donor comes and offers help, you know, you come and work for us, they jump on the opportunity. That's one problem. The second problem is we don't have a theology of the body, and consequently no real theology of commitment. You know, so much of an emphasis on personal salvation that there hasn't been an emphasis on the church, on what it means to be submitting to a body. So that these two things can foster a lack of commitment. So financial accountability, truthfulness, and integrity are real problems. In a biblical community, we are open, we share, and we teach people to walk in the light. Then integrity becomes a shared community value. And in a shame and honor, you know what I mean by shame and honor culture, where right and wrong are determined more by whether it brings honor or shame to you and your people, rather than whether it conforms to a rule. In a shame and honor culture, community, shared community values is the way to bring about change. Written rules and letters, they help. You know, you write a letter saying you need to do this, do this, do this. They can help. But very often there is no change in behavior until it becomes a shared value of the community to which you belong. For example, I always, in our church, I always talk about, and in Youth for Christ, talk about lying. Christians don't lie. And, what is the biggest, I'll ask a question and the members of the congregation will say lying, because they know that's my, that's coming from me. And I know those same people lie. You know, they just lie so blatantly. But if we can develop a community where it is shameful to lie, then they are going to violate community solidarity and make it so much harder to lie. Those not used to being truthful are going to gradually change, or they're going to leave. The thoroughgoing attempt to practice community will include confrontation, discipline, with minimum shame. I think we have to learn how to discipline with minimum shame. For example, Paul, talking to Timothy, says when you are going to, when you are advising older people, it's a passage of rebuke and things like that in 1 Timothy 5, do so as if you were doing it to your father. Now that's a shame and honor approach to confrontation. You respect age, because that's a cultural feature. But you have to do that. Letters without verbal conversation is another huge problem. You know, when a person is sent a letter, you have done this, immediately they become hostile. Because we are not used to written ways of commitment. It's a relational commitment, a verbal ways of commitment. And a conversation can prevent so many big problems that we have in the church. Because the approach to work is relational and not contractual. So spiritual parenthood and discipling, where leaders become fathers or mothers and exercise spiritual care over their people, I think that is the way if we are going to produce people of integrity. Contracts don't. We know of people who live in Australia who get money for a ministry in Sri Lanka with orphans, from Sweden, there is no ministry, but the money comes to Sri Lanka and is funneled back to Australia. They have migrated, but they have signed the contract. And so contracts are not so important to our people. The rule book is not so important. You can easily deceive people. But when there is community, when there is parenthood taking place, it's much more difficult to deceive. This is why I sometimes we are forced to do this, but I prefer not to have this model where you have a supervisor for your work and a pastoral worker for your personal life. Because then you separate work from personal life. So you can be a person without integrity and fool your supervisor because he's not going to ask you about your life. And I really think that even a biblical approach is a more holistic for the supervisor to be also the pastor who cares for you personally. But I think this is one of the, has come with the Western specialization. But people without integrity can remain in a structure like that because they can separate ethics at work from their spiritual life, which is often what happens. Now let me say that once we began to get bigger, we had to develop systems and checks using Western management methodology. And we had a lot of resistance when we started doing that. Don't you trust us? We are giving our own money and you are asking us for all these checks and balances. We don't have time for this kind of worldly things. And so we had to really struggle. That kind of system of checks and balances seems to be out of sync with the shame and honor values of our culture. In businesses, however, they are forced to accept it because that's the way the business works. If you want to get a job, you have to do it. But we are family. We don't have this kind of... We trust each other. So we had to develop a blending of the two cultures, biblical solidarity with family-like community life with business world management required by the law and required by the by our auditors. We found that generally poor people hate rules. I mentioned this, I think, yesterday, because for them rules reminds them of their poverty. The rich don't have to follow rules. They don't have, when you're going by car, if it's a big car that is breaking the speed limit, you can go. If it's a small car, you're caught. The buses are caught. Bus drivers have to have money along with their license when they give it to the policeman. And so they hate rules because rules remind them of their weakness. The strong are exempt. Rules are slapped on the weak. And that is why when I'm in a meeting, I've gone to speak at a camp, for example, and I join the queue for the lunch. Everybody is so uneasy. Why is he in the queue? Send him to the front. Because the leader shouldn't be in the queue. Queues are not for leaders. They can break the queue. It's a completely different approach to the Western approach. I remember reading about... a Massachusetts governor who was running for re-election, and he had after heavy day's work he had gone to a church for lunch, and the lady who was serving, he was hungry, he said she gave him a piece of chicken, and the governor said, "Can I have another piece, please?" He said, no, you can't have another piece. It's only one per person. And then the governor said, "Do you know who I am? I am the governor." And she said, "Do you know who I am? I am the lady serving the cake, the chicken." Now that would be unheard of in our part of the world. But I think we have to demonstrate the beauty of rules in our teaching and our living. We have to demonstrate that submission to rules is a happy thing. something that makes this world a happy place, a beautiful place. So no special privileges for leaders, no special tables at camps for leaders, no breaking queues. We are a group of friends, and respect is fostered in a group like that through godliness, and primarily not through rules. It's a big problem when you get to people say don't get too familiar with the poor; they are going to exploit you, and they lose their respect for you. This is something that we are constantly told. I think the answer to that is not keeping a distance, but living a godly life. If we are godly, they will respect us for that. In countries which followed the colonial missionary pattern amongst the poor, there was that the missionary was the rich benefactor who always gave, and he was a good man, but he was separate from the people. In those countries, there are huge integrity problems in the church. Huge problems. And everybody wants to know, what can I grab? And it's a real problem. I've gone to one of those countries for Youth for Christ work. And it was, I just didn't know how to work with these, with the people. Because there had been this fostering of a grabbing culture from the people who have, and no real ownership in that, in the other sense. A culture of walking in the light and sharing, therefore, is still the best answer to the integrity problems. This is very time consuming. It takes a lot of time to forge this kind of community. This is why if foreigners want to go and start a ministry somewhere, they have to stay a long time. Just not one day, 2 days, and then go back. No rushed visits. There has to be a relationship forged of brothers, sisters, father, mother, son, daughter. That has to be forged. And it takes a lot of time. In our culture, you visit homes. That's an important part of ministry. And for birthdays, for sicknesses, just as part of your job. That kind of relationship. Meetings where not only business is discussed, but also holy conversation. Where you're just chatting about the things of God. What we are doing is, we are essentially developing a relational culture, organizational culture, where Christianity is done relationally. Contracts are necessary, but the atmosphere for making contracts is a relational culture. Because our people don't respect culture, contracts, the way Westerners do. So gradually a sense of family grows. And this was the method of Jesus. After John had said, "Behold the Lamb," two people follow him, and Jesus asks, "What do you want?" And he said, "Where do you live?" And said, "Come and see." And they came and they stayed the whole night with Jesus. And then when he chose his disciples, Mark 3:14, it says, he chose 12, number one, to be with them, then to send them out to preach, and then to give them authority to cast out demons. Then towards the end of his life, he says, I do not call you servants, because the servant doesn't know what the master is doing. I call you my friends, because everything I learned from the Father, I have given to you. So our people imbibe values communally, rather than contractually. I think it's very important for us to develop that culture. And that's a time-consuming thing. But I think unless we realize that, we are going to really flounder in our missionary things. And today you are hearing so many people complaining that they have been taken for a ride. And I think, true, we have to take the blame for that. But I think also the blame was that there wasn't a real effort to act as a community.